Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The focus of Delaware's COVID-19 response has shifted to Sussex County, where cases are rising more quickly than elsewhere.
We still need to think about, kind of the longer trajectory of what COVID-19 looks like and, how can we keep those numbers down to try to not only protect individuals, but protect the collective community.
We chat with a DSU expert on global health and epidemics about the status of efforts to battle the pandemic in the first state. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn more about a recent study of Newcastle County sewer waste that claims many more residents there have had COVID-19 than traditional lab testing indicates. Plus, we check in on the impact of a dam removal project along the Brandywine and bring you another arts playlist. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The center of the coronavirus outbreak and response in Delaware has shifted in recent weeks. Efforts are increasingly focused on Sussex County, where the outbreak seems to be the most severe. This week, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt checks in with Donna Patterson, an expert on global health and epidemics at Delaware State University, on the state of Delaware's outbreak and response.
Dr. Patterson, it's great to have you on again. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So since the last time we talked, what we know about the outbreak in Delaware has changed in a couple of ways. The number of positive tests have ballooned in Sussex County. The state started releasing racial and ethnic information for the known cases. And through that, we learned that Sussex County Hispanic and Latino residents are being hit the hardest, followed by Black Delawareans in Sussex. So do you have any insight as to why we're seeing, these particular patterns?
Why are we seeing more Black people impacted in Newcastle and more Hispanics in Sussex County? I think it's still preliminary. I think definitely in terms of diversity of the state, there's a sizable Black population in the Wilmington area. So that could be some of it. But also, I think perhaps both in Wilmington and Sussex or both in Newcastle County and Sussex County, one of the things that we're seeing is that a lot of people of color are essential workers. And we're seeing this trend in other states throughout the country. We're seeing this in cities. We're seeing this in New York. We're seeing this in Detroit. We're seeing this in New Orleans and other things. I think there are some multiple things going on kind of with the racial impact and the number of people who are affected.
Yeah, and I guess that I was going to ask just specifically why Sussex? Like, did you see it coming that the most rural county was going to be the place where we have the biggest outbreak? I mean, do you think it has to do with some of those essential industries being down there?
I think that's some of it. I think, too, when we were looking early, kind of early on, because in Delaware, our numbers rose later than a lot of the neighboring states. But one of the things we were seeing, particularly in the early weeks of March, early to mid-March, were, people trying to go to the beach, people, from other places moving down or going down for short periods of time, which I think probably was part of the impetus for the governor, to change some of these policies about, if you're coming in, you can't do the short stays in a hotel and these other things, trying to help protect the population of Delaware. So I think it's a combination of things. I think, too, as things go on, we have more data and we'll have a better sense of all the variables that were a part of this.
Yeah. Okay. And another thing that we've talked about a few times at this point is testing. So a couple of weeks ago, you felt the state was doing a pretty good job setting up a statewide testing system. I think that was the last time we talked. You felt we were being fairly proactive. Do you still think that at this point we're staying on track with the amount of testing we're doing?
I think we're doing even more testing than we were doing then. I think one of the things that we saw the last time we talked, which was probably 4 or 5 weeks ago, was that the rate of those who were testing positive was probably about 10%. And this went on for maybe a couple of more weeks. But now what we're seeing is, yes, we're doing more tests. There are more people coming back positive, but also the ratio of those who are positive is higher than 10%. It's varying to some degree, by day, but it's probably twice that on average at this point. And so I think that's, something that we may want to take a closer look at.
So I guess this gets a little bit into the way, you know, it's a little bit chicken and the egg-ish with this issue, but the state has also released testing rates in specific zip codes and whatnot. And at this point, Sussex has the highest testing rate per capita. Georgetown has the highest. And that's kind of tracking with where we're seeing the most cases. So do you think, like, is the way we're testing just based on where we see the need, does it give us an accurate picture of the outbreak?
Well, I think you're right. There is some chicken in the egg. I think early on, most of the testing was actually in Newcastle, which might have led to more numbers being in Newcastle. But I think, too, Newcastle was ripe to have a lot of cases, just given where it is kind of on the 95 corridor. So it could be some of that in terms of you're doing more testing. So whenever you're doing more testing, you're going to have more cases. So either if it's, you know, one of the counties in our state or the state as a whole or a different state, because one of the things that we've talked about in some of our earlier conversations is, you know, that even before there was a case declared, a confirmed case in Delaware, I would often say, you know, there are cases here, we just don't know because we're not testing. And so I think that is some of it. As you test more, you will see more cases. And the numbers are probably showing higher. One of the things, too, you know, they've been doing tests in different places, including in Newcastle County, of, you know, sewage and, you know, testing these communities and getting, trying to get a sense of the numbers of people who are infected. And if you look at some of those preliminary results, the numbers are much higher than the numbers that we see as confirmed cases.
Mm-hmm. So one last point on testing, something kind of interesting in the past few days is they started doing these community testing events in Sussex. And Dr. Hong with the Division of Public Health mentioned during a virtual town hall a couple days ago that they're not just testing symptomatic people, as kind of was the protocol when the first statewide testing system went into effect. They had a couple like characteristics of who the testing's geared toward, kind of based on like who you live with or what industry you worked on, not just symptomatic. So does that feel like an, you know, a big development in the way that we're testing here?
Absolutely. I think that's the sort of thing that I was talking about from the beginning. That's how you do it with epidemics and pandemics. You test those who are at risk. You test those that they've been in contact with, and you move from there. You contact trace and you try to contain. If we started that, both in the state, but definitely in the nation, because, you know, it started in other states well before it came to Delaware, you know, that sort of contact tracing and local containment, it would have helped reduce our numbers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so another thing to kind of check in on is hospital capacity. I think the last time we talked, we just had our first hospitalizations, and now we've seen them as high as like the low 300s. But it hasn't really been like a steady uptick with the hospitalizations. Some days it goes down, and state officials have said that basically we're tracking below their initial projections for hospitalizations. So do you think we're like out of the woods on the issue of hospital capacity, or are there still areas that worry you on that front?
The numbers were projected, I believe, in the 2,000s, 3,000s, which were going to be over capacity. So this is really good in terms of the numbers that we are seeing. Of course, that doesn't take into account everyone who is infected, because a lot of people aren't admitted. So I guess the good thing is that they're not having a lot of them, or not having, you know, very advanced cases. But at the same time, we know that some people are, because we have had a number of deaths in the state. So hospital capacity looks good at this point. We hope that it remains that way, because the numbers keep going up in Delaware, and they've gone up so much in the past 3 weeks. Because, you know, in the past 3 weeks, we've actually doubled our numbers in the state. And so I think, you know, we still need to kind of wait and see where this is going in Delaware.
So, yeah, specifically in like a geographic sense, we had spoken about there being always kind of a concern with capacity in rural areas, just because, mm-hmm. you know, there tends mm-hmm. to be not as much. Mm-hmm. And now that our outbreak does seem to be centered in Sussex, is that concerning that we'll have enough hospital capacity down there?
That is concerning. I mean, you do have a few big regional hospitals, both in Delaware. I'd say a couple of big ones in Delaware, and some, you know, in neighboring Delmarva, and particularly in Maryland, that are close to some of those areas. But if the numbers continue to spike in the patterns that we've been seeing, in the past 2 to 3 weeks, yes, it's concerning. Because the capacity, because you're not just having people who are going in with COVID cases, even though they're majority in the number of cases. You're going to have people who are going for emergency surgery and people who are going in for, you know, perhaps a road accident. And so you're not just having people with COVID come in. So you already have a certain level of capacity, you know, a number of people who are already in the hospital. And then as these numbers spike, absolutely, this could be an issue.
Okay, so I guess in terms of the big question, where are we on the curve of the outbreak? This past week, we had a couple days with really big announcements of cases, like more than 400, which mm-hmm. was the most we'd mm-hmm. seen. And then we also had a couple days where we had like 70, 80 new cases. So should we read into those smaller increases as a good sign? Like, how can we really get a sense when it feels like the daily increases are kind of sporadic?
What we're seeing in terms of numbers, they are sporadic, but some of that has to do with testing in terms of lag and test time, particularly tests that are sent out of state. And so sometimes they come in a bundle. And so there's that. But I think we need to be more concerned about the numbers, particularly since they have gone up so much. They have spiked so much in the past 3 weeks. So there was about a 10 day window there in those 3 weeks where the number of cases actually doubled in the state of Delaware. And that's very concerning. And I don't think we're at a place now where we can relax. And I think that's very important. Since Good Friday in the state of Delaware, just, you know, as I kind of ride around and try to look and see what people are doing, you know, how are they doing with social distancing? Are they, you know, adhering to first the advice and now in terms of the state order to wear a mask and that sort of thing? There's been a lot of traffic since Good Friday around, particularly in the greater Dover area. And I'm hearing reports that this is happening in other places. I'm hearing reports of, you know, despite the beaches now being closed, people are just, you know, going past the barricades and going onto the beach and that sort of thing. And so, you know, this is concerning to some degree. So social distancing was put there for a reason. And, you know, I understand that the weather is warmer and that sort of thing, and people are tired of being in the house. But we still need to think about, you know, kind of the longer trajectory of what COVID-19 looks like. And, you know, how can we keep those numbers down to try to not only protect individuals, but protect the collective community?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, you touched on there is sort of this impatience, it feels like, that's bubbling up in the past week or so. About reopening. So there's been like some small demonstrations, a call from some Republican lawmakers Thursday to open up quicker. So what indicators do you think the state should be looking at as it actually decides when to start this process?
Oh, definitely you want the numbers to stabilize. The numbers to stabilize, I think as things seem to get numbers start to get more steady and they're lowered and lowered on a consistent basis, that the state probably will start talking about next steps, about what numbers, what projected numbers do they want to see before they reopen things. We're already seeing this, for instance, in Pennsylvania, in different parts of the state, including Philadelphia. They're well away, and particularly in Philadelphia, from the numbers that they want to see. But they're saying, you know, once we get to these numbers, then we're going to be able to reopen things, you know, in stages. And I think that's the other thing. A lot of states are thinking about these things in stages. Even some of the states that we're seeing that are reopening now in different parts of the country, particularly the South and the Midwest, many of them are reopening in stages. Some are doing it more widely, but many of them aren't fully reopening for certain. So I think that's one of the things they're going to look at. They're going to look at the number of deaths from COVID-19. And probably the trends, particularly in neighboring states, because I think neighboring states have been used as a model in many cases for Delaware and this new consortium that you see with these states, kind of from Delaware up to Massachusetts, those six states. So that's one thing. But also, I think advice from the CDC, the World Health Organization, and other big public health organizations.
Dr. Donna Patterson, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sophia. And Sophia rejoins us in a moment to dig deeper into the method behind testing results announced last week by Newcastle County that indicate many more residents there have had COVID-19 than what current lab testing shows. Stay with us for that here on The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Last week, Newcastle County announced results of a test that claims to estimate how many people have a COVID-19 infection countywide, whether or not they've been tested in a lab. The study by Massachusetts-based startup Biobot uses samples from sewers to estimate the prevalence of the virus based on traces of it shed through stool. The company has used a similar approach to track the extent of the opioid epidemic. Biobot estimated more than 15,000 Newcastle County residents could have been infected with the virus 2 weeks ago, an order of magnitude higher than the number confirmed by lab tests at the time. But it is unclear how accurate Biobot's estimate is, and County Executive Matt Meyer emphasized their method is unconfirmed. Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talks with Biobot co-founder Nusha Gailey about how she thinks this estimate should be used.
So could you describe for folks who aren't familiar with the science behind this, how does this type of study work? How is it that you can estimate an infection rate from looking at a wastewater sample?
Yeah, if you think about it, sewage is really just a collection of our urine and stool, as well as a bunch of other stuff. But at its core, our sewer infrastructure is meant to move, you know, enormous amounts of human waste outside of the city, where it's treated and cleaned and has an entirely other process. And so in the same way that our doctors can understand a lot about our health and well-being by looking at our urine or stool samples, we believe that we can understand a lot about a community by looking at sewage and sewage samples.
So in the case of COVID-19, what is it that looking at a sewer can tell you that maybe traditional testing can't?
So about 2 months ago now, there were some initial studies that were showing and started to tell us that the novel coronavirus, so SARS-CoV-2, was actually shed in the stool of infected patients. And this is not uncommon with viruses or infectious disease. There's a lot of diseases where you are shedding the virus in fecal matter. And so because when we became aware that this was happening, we knew that we would be able to theoretically detect the virus in our sewer systems. So in March or late February, March, we started developing the methods in order to actually detect and also start to quantify the virus and the amount of virus in sewage in order to very rapidly be able to understand the number or estimate the number of infected individuals in a large region.
And to clarify, is this an active infection or can it also detect whether you've had one in the past?
So our technology cannot distinguish between a live or a dead virus, but rather we're detecting the genetic fragments of the virus. So a good way to think about it is when we're measuring, you know, and estimating the number of cases based on a sewage sample, a good way to think about it is that those are the active cases in a community. So what we need more information on, for example, is how long after a COVID patient has recovered are they still shedding the virus in their stool. They may have recovered, but they may still be shedding it. However, it's still important for us to understand that information because they may theoretically still be infectious. And so we should still be counting this information and it should still be feeding into our understanding of the scope of the outbreak from a policy and decision-making perspective.
Got it. Okay. And how precise of an estimate is this? Do you have like a range of error that you work with, or are there any caveats that in maybe one municipality it could give you a better estimate than in another?
Yeah. So what's really important when thinking about how to interpret the data that we're generating is that we are getting a raw concentration of the virus, the amount of the virus in a liter of sewage. And what's important is looking at that number as a qualitative trend. So over time, week to week, comparing that number with the week prior will help us really understand how the levels of the virus are increasing and decreasing. Because that precise number, the number of cases, for example, that we're estimating, that number, our model that's used to estimate that number is going to be refined over time as we get more samples in and as, you know, our data science process and pipeline just gets more intelligent. And so that's where we see a huge value in this information is really being used as qualitative trending when making very high level decisions around when and how we can responsibly and you know, safely open up our cities and our communities again.
Okay, so I think our, you know, I'm calling from Newcastle County, Delaware, which, you know, one of the participating municipalities, our county executive said to some of the folks in the media that that is something they plan to do, you know, take a couple tests over time and hopefully get a sense for where in the curve we are. They also mentioned hopefully or possibly being able to use it to spot hotspots, geographic hotspots. Can you talk about that a little bit? Is that something you recommend and what are the limitations?
Yeah, absolutely. So we do have, you know, there are quite a few communities that are interested in leveraging this technology to understand where they might have pockets of the outbreak. You know, I'd say to give you a sense of the number of people that are represented in a sample, at the moment, we're sampling anywhere between like tens of thousands, so 10, 20,000 individuals, up to like over a million people in a single sample. And so that really depends on, that number really depends on where we take the sample from, like where in the sewer network are we taking the sample from. So as you get kind of move up within the sewer network, you can start to carve out pockets of, let's say, tens of thousands of individuals and very rapidly get a neighborhood or a community level sort of diagnosis of, do we see the amount of virus sort of resurging in this community? Should we be putting out recommendations that people stay at home and implement social distancing type practices? Or are we, you know, very confidently seeing the amount of virus receding?
Got it. Okay. So as long as you can actually get into the sewer at, you know, a more precise point, then you can do that. Wondering, has your, you know, this method, has it been confirmed anywhere with lab testing? And if not, is that something that you are hoping to do down the line?
What do you mean?
I guess I mean, like, if you were able to have, you know, a small enough catchment area where you actually could test everyone with the, you know, the traditional nose swab, could you compare your percentage?
Right. So that actually, that hasn't happened yet. I guess in theory, you could set up a controlled study like that. We do have thoughts around some studies that we can set up similar, but not quite exactly like that, to help us also get better understanding of our estimates and our model. So those are all sort of in the works, and we are planning on executing those. But we also think in parallel, it's just very important to get this data out to as many communities as possible, as sort of the focus of the country is now shifting to when and how to reopen our communities. Testing at scale is critical. And we know that it's not realistic to assume that we're going to have a test for every single person. And so we need to find another way to have complementary data, something that can complement clinical cases at that, you know, massive population level. And we're hopeful that this information will be used for that.
Yeah. And I guess you've used the word, like, using it as a qualitative data point. In, you know, we got this number, 15,200 possible cases in our county from this. Would you recommend, like, you know, don't really focus in on the number, but use that to say we could have potentially thousands? Or, like, to what level would you interpret that when making these policy decisions?
Yeah, I mean, my interpretation from that would be that we are, you know, likely an order of magnitude higher than the confirmed number of clinical cases. And that could be for a variety of reasons. It could be that, you know, current healthcare recommendations for individuals who even have symptoms is to stay at home and try and take care of the illness at home and manage it at home unless they absolutely need medical, critical medical attention. So they're not even everyone who believes that they're sick is getting tested. But this number could also represent a large number of individuals who are asymptomatic, who don't have symptoms or have very mild symptoms. And so they're not even seeking out testing to begin with.
Nusha Gailey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks to our Sophia Schmidt for joining us on The Green this week. And The Green continues with a look at the early results of a dam removal project along the Brandywine, designed to bring Shad and Moore back to that waterway. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Some good news emerging in a story we previously covered here on The Green. Back in January, contributor John Hurdle reported on how a series of dams along the Brandywine that date back some 200 years were being targeted for removal or modification. The goal, to allow shad, eels, and other fish to return to their ancestral spawning grounds again for the first time in two centuries. This week, John Hurdle returns to tell us there's evidence the effort is paying off. His piece on what's being seen along the Brandywine is available at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me earlier this week to discuss it. So let's start with what's being seen on the Brandywine right now. What are those who are watching this effort to take down the dams and allow shad and other things to move up the river seeing this spring?
Well, quite simply, they're seeing the fish return, and there are different species of fish, but the most prized are the shad, and they're prized because they're kind of they were previously present in local creeks and rivers in huge numbers, and so for example, they became a significant source of food for colonial Americans, and so they have this. So the shad, that is the two species of shad, the American shad and hickory shad, both have some kind of a significance to historical significance to local people. So these are beginning to appear in the lower section of the Brandywine Creek for the first time since, probably a couple of hundred years since those early dams started to be constructed on the creek.
And your story notes that anglers fishing in that area confirm that things are picking up with the shad.
That's right. The advocates for this dam removal program predicted that as soon as the fish started moving up in significant numbers, then of course you would see anglers coming, and that's that has turned out to be the case. I took a visit down to the creek in the region of the now removed West Street Dam in Wilmington. That was on April 23rd. I talked to three anglers there, one of whom said that he'd already caught 12 shad in the morning that he'd been there. And so they were all pretty excited about the idea of these fish becoming available again after such a long time.
This is a pretty quick indication that predictions that shad and more would return were actually on target. Is it surprising that it happened this quickly?
Well, it's not really a surprise, Tom. And there's evidence that that if the dams, that when dams are removed, the physical barriers are removed that have prevented these fish from going upstream to their ancestral spawning grounds, then they return very quickly. And so local evidence is back in 2014, revolutionary era dam was removed from the White Clay Creek near Newark. And the following season, the fish started to appear. There's also been this experience in the Musconetcong River in northwestern New Jersey. The local watershed association there has been removing about half a dozen dams over the last 10 years, and their experience too is that is that as soon as the dams are removed, the fish return and they move as far upstream as they're able to get.
And I guess as you reported, the hope is this is not just going to be about shad and some of this other marine life, that there's other things that are expected to return along with it. What's expected to return along with these fish?
Well, I think that the most visible signs of the return of the fish accompanying them will be birds of prey. One of the anglers that I talked to said that he'd never seen so many bald eagles and osprey on the creek. And of course, you know, they're simply just following the fish. And in fact, during my visit down there, when I was conducting interviews with some of these anglers and advocates, there was an osprey flying over the creek as if right on cue. So there was the evidence.
And it appears that the return of the shad is also, as you kind of noted by these discussions with anglers who are already there, is actually drawing people back to the Brandywine. Is it likely the Brandywine is going to become a bigger draw because the fish and these other things are returning to it?
Well, I think so, yes. I mean, if you consider that if there are birds of prey, and the fish will bring the birds of prey, and the birds of prey will probably bring bird watchers. And the advocates for this program are also, the dam removal program, are also saying that with fewer dams on the creek, that's going to make it easier for people who want to paddle their kayaks or their canoes in the creek, and potentially for others as well who simply want to get out into the countryside and find that it's a more inviting prospect.
Remind us where we are in the process of this dam removal effort. What's already happened and what's still to come?
Well, the big picture, Tom, is that 11 dams will eventually be removed from the Brandywine Creek. If and when that work is done, it will allow the fish to move up to their historic spawning grounds, which are in the Pennsylvania section of the creek. The only dam that has actually been fully removed so far is the one at West Street in Wilmington, and that came down late last year. So the fish flow that we've been seeing so far this spring is the first season when that's been possible to happen. So the plan for this year is to remove three more of the dams, and that will be dependent on the availability of funding. Advocates are hoping to get $490,000 from the federal government, and they're also hoping that sum will be matched by the state. But as of right now, the folks who are leading the charge here, called Brandywine Shad 2020, are cautiously optimistic on both those sources of funding.
And you also mentioned, just to kind of circle back to what is in the plans, some of these dams won't be completely taken out. Some of them are just going to be modified to allow fish to move through them without them actually being completely removed, right?
That's correct, yes. And the reason for that is that several of the dams are historic structures. That is, there are several of them near the Hagley Museum and Library that are historic structures. So they cannot be removed for that reason. And so there are different techniques that are being different mechanisms, if you like, that are going to be installed on those dams to allow the fish to get to the next upstream section of the creek.
So with the COVID-19 pandemic ongoing, does that create any roadblocks either logistically for doing some of this work, or you mentioned the financial piece, is that also kind of on shaky ground?
Well, I think that the financial part of it is potentially a more of a problem. Speaking with one of the officials from the Brandywine Shad 2020, he said that even though they are relatively confident that they will be getting this federal and state funding, they're less confident that they will be able to attract donations from private foundations, simply because many of those foundations are having to write a lot of checks right now to help COVID-related causes.
But I guess the overall story here is that things seem to be on the right track with this effort. And if so, does ultimately the Brandywine perhaps see something of both an environmental and recreational renaissance?
Well, that's certainly the hope of the advocates here. They see the removal of the dams as the final piece in the puzzle get rid of the different factors that reduced the population of the shad since the dams were built, but the other major factors being water pollution, and that was addressed by the Federal Clean Water Act in 1972, and it's resulted in a much cleaner water sources that allow these migratory fish to return. And the other point was overfishing, and and that's been addressed by federal regulation. And so with the dam removal, the advocates are seeing that this will finish the process and create favorable conditions for these fish to return in significant numbers.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time on The Green this week. You can read his reporting about the return of shad to the Brandywine at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We wrap up the show with Arts Playlist and a look at virtual programming now being offered by the Delaware Art Museum. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. As the coronavirus pandemic continues, the Delaware Art Museum in Wilmington is ramping up its virtual programming to stay engaged with people who, for now, cannot visit the museum in person. Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele recently spoke to Sarah Lynn Rosenfield, the museum's Director of Learning and Engagement, about this new virtual programming and its potential beyond the pandemic.
Thank you for joining me, Sarah Lynn.
Thank you for having me, Kelly.
Hey, let's talk about this. First, let everybody know the museum is still closed, and then talk about this slate of virtual programming you guys have going on.
Yeah, so the museum has been closed since about mid-March, and what we've done is we've looked at all the programming that we were going to offer, and we've tried to figure out some sort of way to make it virtual and put it online and make it accessible to our community. And so we had everything from family programs, which we were offering regularly every month on the second Sunday, and storybook programs on Fridays. We also had performances that were planned, and we had a whole slate of studio classes that we were going to do. So we've been working really hard with our teaching artists and our staff to come up with how we can make these activities virtual. And so we've done things like recording story book readings. We actually did a few in the galleries before we were officially closed, and looking at works of art. We're also looking at, we're working with our teaching artists to create demos of their artwork from home. And so many of them are showing us their studio and showing us how they're making things in their own homes. We're also doing virtual studio tours. Some artists have agreed, local artists have agreed to show us their studios. And we actually did our first watch party the other week where we showed some of our local performers a singular one. And we're going to continue to do that and feature them for about 20 to 30 minutes once a month on Fridays.
You know, Sarah Lynn, art is so visual. This couldn't have been an easy task to put all this together.
No, it's not. It's not easy, but we're very fortunate to have some support. We have a wonderful digital storyteller who is always online and looking for how to engage people online. So this is, we're really working a lot more closely with her and our marketing team on it. We also were fortunate to have a lot of our collection digitized. And so even though we can't be in the museum to be in front of a work of art, we can at least get to our collection through our through eMuseum, which is available on our website. So we've been able to access artwork that way. I think what's a little bit harder is figuring out how to help people be creative remotely.
Is this a new way that you can foresee, as an expert here, can you foresee this being the new way to get the Delaware Art Museum and what you present out there to the general public?
You know, that's a really good question and something that me and my colleagues, as well as the field, has really been thinking a lot about. Many museums have been offering digital components to their work for a long time, and we haven't really been able to do that as much just because our audience, it seems, enjoys a more in-person experience. But I do think that virtual offerings is going to outlast this pandemic, and I think that for a while we'll be straddling both worlds, where we'll have people coming back on site, but also more people will be excited to join online programming. So we are going to continue to experiment with that, and we're asking our audiences, you know, what times of day they're interested in participating. Are they willing to donate or pay for a program? Could some of the things that were going to be in our auditorium with a lot of people be moved online, where we could actually, there's a benefit to that, where we don't just have to serve people who can easily get to us, we can actually serve people from all around the world with online programs. So we're excited about the possibilities.
Let's remind people we're talking to Sarah Lynn Rosenfield. She is the Director of Learning and Engagement at the Delaware Art Museum. Sarah Lynn, I'm reading the press release. I like this. The museum, it says, will also be releasing a special Art Museum Babies video. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so I unfortunately can't give away too much because I don't know what the person is working on entirely, but I can tell you that once a month we had a very popular growing program of parents and their babies attending this activity on Family Second Sundays called Art Museum Babies. And what I presume that this person is going to do is that they're going to share activities that can engage their infants at home with creative making, things that we would have done on site in our public spaces.
That sounds like a lot of fun. All right, you touched base on some of the things you're doing. You mentioned watch parties. Can you go into more detail about those?
Yes. So some of the watch parties, what we're doing is we were working with a lot of our local musicians, and either they were going to be on site performing this summer, or they had worked with us in the past, or we anticipated engaging them for a performance at the museum later on this year. And so our manager of performance programs, Jonathan Whitney, reached out to our contacts in the community to see if they would be available to try to record a session from home. And so they've been recording their own music individually and submitting them to us. And what we do is we have a time and place that we will, or time online, where we'll do a Facebook Live video, 6:30 on once a month on Fridays. I believe the next one is May 22nd. All of our information is available online at delart.org, and there is a link to connect with the museum from home that has more of this information. So they've been recording these concerts, and I attended the one that we did last Friday, and it was just really lovely to eat my dinner and be able to enjoy some local music from my own home.
Yeah, that's great. This is also exciting. What kind of feedback have you been getting about this virtual programming from people?
Well, you know, a lot of it is in numbers and how we're seeing people engage with this online and who's, you know, how many people are actually participating. And for the watch party, we had consistently around 50 people, which for us was great to launch and start with. And I think that there is about over 500 impressions. So we're starting to think about, like, how many people are actually getting to experience this from that aren't necessarily coming to the museum. But we've also been getting some great feedback from the community thanking us for continuing to bring the museum to them. They really miss coming to the museum. They're especially sad because they really are looking forward to our summer happy hours that we usually have on Thursdays. And so I think, at least with the concerts, it's reminding them of a more laid-back, casual evening at the museum. And it's something that they miss and that they're glad that we're still looking to provide.
This is also great for adults and children alike. And I bring up the children, you know, many parents home from work right now. They're either laid off because of the coronavirus pandemic, or they're being forced to work from home because the kids can't be in school, so they have to stay home with the kids. You have on the museum's Facebook page a lot of kid-friendly art fun there too, right?
So we also have a lot of art activity lesson plans that we're sharing with our audiences. And we are, these are things that we had previously put together, but also we're working with our teaching artists to come up with these lesson plans as well. And they're getting creative themselves. So we want families and adults to feel like they can do these things from home. So we're adapting lesson plans so that they can use materials that are available to them. We're also linking to other places that are doing wonderful art projects that, you know, we don't necessarily need to come up with, but we think are really cool from other museums or other online crafters and teachers that we want to share.
Gotcha. Sarah Lynn, anything else that the Delaware Art Museum is doing with this virtual programming that I haven't asked about that you want to get out to the general public?
Yeah, so next month in May, there are three dates, May 13th, May 17th, and May 21st. I think it's May 21st. We are going to be testing another type of virtual program where we're going to have conversations with curators, and we're going to bring in guest speakers. And so they're going to be a very participatory experience, but it's a good opportunity for people who really still want their art history fixed and want to socialize with other people. We're going to give a really intimate experience to be able to get to know our curators and get to know what's interesting, that what they've been looking at and what they've been interested in researching.
Thanks to the Delaware Art Museum's Director of Learning and Engagement, Sarah Lynn Rosenfield, and R. Kelly Steele for bringing us this week's Arts Playlist. To check out the Delaware Art Museum's virtual programming, head to their website, delart.org. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor John Hurdle, and Delaware Public Media Sophia Schmidt and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.